From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mae Sarton reflects on her long life of poetry and solitude. Sarton is the author of over 35 books, but she's probably best known for her journals, which chronicle aging alone. Also today, virtuoso recorder player and conductor Franz Bruggen. He created the orchestra of the 18th century to perform music from Bach to Beethoven on period instruments in the language of the time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews vintage recordings by guitarist Eddie Condon, and TV critic David Bianculli previews the return of Telly Savalas and Kojak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. San Francisco is coping with the biggest traffic headache in its history on the Bay Area's first full day since Tuesday's earthquake. Elaine Corey from CalNet Public Radio reports.
Transit disruptions caused by the quake were compounded last night. A fierce winter storm flooded many of the alternate routes commuters had hoped to take to work. It was not the gridlock that some had feared, but today's commute was no picnic either.
It's nuts. There's a million people, lots of rain, lots of wind. People are losing their tempers. It's crazy.
Damage to the Bay Bridge has funneled an estimated 100,000 additional commuters onto other Bay Area bridges, BART trains, and a network of ferries crisscrossing the bay. Employers are doing what they can to help, forming employee van pools, offering their workers flexible start times, and encouraging some of them to stay home and work via computer. For National Public Radio, I'm Elaine Corey in San Francisco.
A series of explosions at a Phillips Petroleum Plastics plant near Houston today hurled chunks of metal and other debris miles away and sent up a fireball visible 15 miles away. More than 80 people were injured. The blast buckled a ceiling and blew out cafeteria windows at an elementary school about a mile away. None of the 700 pupils was injured. The complex is the site of the main refining center of petroleum products in the United States. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze today called the 9-year Soviet intervention in Afghanistan illegal. He said the action violated human values. NPR's Ann Cooper has details.
Shevardnadze said the 1979 decision to send troops into Afghanistan was made behind the back of the public and in violation of Soviet law. He said that despite his high rank within the Communist Party at that time, he learned of the intervention only from media reports. Shevardnadze's blunt assessment, offered in a broad-ranging foreign policy speech today, was the first such criticism by a top Soviet leader. When the Soviet troop withdrawal from Afghanistan was completed last February, Soviet officials were still calling their 9-year war a noble mission. Today, Shevardnadze appeared to open the way for a broad reassessment of that view. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The space shuttle Atlantis returned to Earth at Edwards Air Force Base today after a 5-day mission. The 5 Atlantis astronauts successfully sent the Galileo space probe on a 2.5-billion-mile journey to Jupiter. Galileo is said to be operating flawlessly, passing the 1-million-mile mark at a speed of nearly 9,000 miles an hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 26 points today to close at 2662.91. Declines led advances 2-1 on volume of 136 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush signed into law today the most sweeping moratoriums on offshore oil drilling ever approved by Congress and the resolution of a dispute over ancient forests and spotted owls in the Pacific Northwest. Both the delays in offshore drilling and the settlement in the timber dispute were enacted as part of an $11 billion spending bill for the Interior Department and related agencies, including arts and cultural programs. The chairman of Boeing Company today defended the aircraft manufacturer's 3-year contract proposal for nearly 58,000 striking machinists. From Seattle, Carol Levinson reports.
In a rare session with reporters, Boeing Chairman Frank Schrantz said the company's proposed 10% wage increase, cost of living increase, and bonus payment is the best offer in recent history by any large company. The fact that Boeing has been making record profits, Schrantz says, is misleading.
Our profits last year, I think by almost any industry standards, were disappointing. Our pre tax operating profit was less than 3%. And I don't think it's possible to say that the Boeing company at this point has an embarrassment of riches.
Schrantz says the company is ready to go back to the bargaining table when the union has something different to request. At the same time, Schrantz reiterated Boeing's stance that it's not willing to increase the value of the package workers rejected nearly 3 weeks ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
8 African National Congress leaders, including 7 freed from prison this month, held a strategy meeting today in South Africa. A statement issued after the meeting said the men would consult with exiled officials of the ANC and would address policy issues at a mass rally Sunday at a soccer stadium near Johannesburg. Police in Chile said today a West German woman who was lost on a mountain in southern Chile for 13 days survived by eating roots, leaves, and snow. Police patrol rescued marine biologist Ingeborg Bredmeier late yesterday after a farmer spotted her in a gorge. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mae Sarton has become a heroic figure to many of her readers because she's had the courage to go her own way. Sarton is 77 now, and since she was 45, she's chosen to live the life of solitude. She's chronicled that life in a series of journals that have inspired her readers to reflect on their lives as she has reflected on hers. Her recent journals describe aging alone and recovering from a mild stroke at her home in Maine. Sarton is also the author of many novels and books of poems. She recently completed her first novel since her stroke. It's called The Education of Harriet Hatfield, and it's about a 60-year-old woman who, for the first time, comes out publicly as a lesbian. It was in 1965, after writing several novels about married couples, that Sarton wrote her first novel with a lesbian protagonist. She says, "On the surface, my work has not looked radical, but perhaps it will be seen eventually that in a nice, quiet, noisy way, I have been trying to say radical things gently so that they may penetrate without shock." Most of the letters Sarton gets are from women and men who relate to her writing about solitude, and it's with solitude that we begin.
Well, I've always needed a lot of it. You see, I was an only child. My father, a scholar who was very concentrated on his work, my mother, an artist. That is, even in my family life, I was a solitary. I loved other children. I mean, I'd rush off to school early in the morning. It's not that. But solitude has always been a necessity for me, partly because I think I believe this is true of everybody. You really only experience something when you have the chance to sit down and think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said that without solitude, you feel you lose your center.
Yes, that's right. Because your center, after all, is made out of your thinking about what has happened to you. It's, I think, and it's constantly being remade. But if you're too much clutter, it's just what I feel about my house right now. There's so many little things. I'm just going to get rid of the clutter. And that's what solitude does for you.
Now, how remote is your home?
Well, it's not really very remote, but there's nobody within. If I was attacked, nobody would hear me scream. It looks down a lovely field to the ocean, and what you hear all night is that sighing of the ocean. And when I first came there, I used to think that there was a train going by somewhere, and then I'd realize it was the ocean.
Do you worry about being attacked?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, I'm a fatalist, and two, this is a very remote place, and three, it seems a very benign town. I mean, it's hard to imagine something violent happening there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came, I did get some threats, but that was a private vendetta against me by some people. And that was frightening when I got a note saying, you know, enjoy it now, we're going to get you, and things like that.
Yeah.
But then I went to the post office, I went to any shops or cleaners, that kind of thing, florist, and said, you told them the situation, and said, never tell anybody where I live. It's rather hard to find, and nobody has found it. So that's really worked very well.
Mm-hmm. As much as you like solitude, you've also called it your self-imposed solitary confinement. And in your journals, really, there's really quite a bit about depression.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it's inevitable. If you're a writer, a serious writer, there's bound to be some depression. You can't every day get up and say, I'm a genius and everything's great. I mean, you're fighting something all the time. You're a lot of the time you're in conflict, and some of the writing certainly comes out of that. For instance, my novel Anger. Anger has been a constant in my life. I'm an angry temperament in some ways, And I wanted to get at that. And so I really wrote the novel to find out myself what it was all about. And this is what my writing is anyway. It's a lot of the time is to find out what I really feel, what I really think about something.
A lot of your readers identify so strongly with your writing and I think even want to be you. And you've said that there's something wrong when solitude such as yours can be envied by a happily married woman. Why?
Did I say
yes,
that?
Yes, you did in one of the journals.
Because I don't remember that, because I think it's fairly natural. In other words, uh-huh. There are these opposites in all of us. There's a part of me which would love to have a large family uh-huh. and now be a grandmother. And there's a part of every woman who's married and has the responsibilities of children and who just thinks of my life as ideal. I mean, she does what she wants. She gets up when she feels like it. You know, she goes for a walk with her cat. And that's the other side. It's just that we are all such a bundle of opposites, I think.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, that's really it. But then I am certainly dedicated in the sense that there is one thing in my life that I would give up everything else for, and that is my work.
Your writing.
My writing.
And
yes.
My guest is writer Mae Sarton. You've said that we have to make myths of our lives, and I think in a way you're making a myth of your life through always writing journals.
Yes, although I started very late on that. But I think that the answer about the myth is that you have to have an image of yourself which is viable for you. And my image of myself does have to do with solitude. There's no doubt about that. And then the enormous response to the journals, which are written, of course, in solitude and are mostly about the sort of sacred routines. Sacred is an odd word, but I really believe this to be true. And somebody compared me to the painter Vermeer recently in a thesis they were writing, because it was the sacramentalization of the ordinary. You remember the Vermeer women who are nearly always writing a letter or sewing or doing something very feminine and concentrated. And it the magic of these paintings, of course, is the light. But also the fact that we carry away an image of something very feminine, which is very precious. And I use even the word sacred. So I think, for instance, that if you can make dishwashing a sort of a ritual which has meaning for you, it's a tremendous advance. And this is what I try to do with my life.
Does writing journals help you think of your life in that way?
It does, but of course I'd thought all those things long before. You see, I started my first journal, I think, when I was 60.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was late in my life. My life was shaped then, and it was an experiment because I was very depressed, and I thought if I can write about this, maybe I can solve it. It was an unhappy love affair that I was involved in, and in fact, in that book, the lover is X. Neither man nor woman. I'm a little braver now than I was then. But anyway, the people, you know, are always saying, why is it X? And I just say because I was shy then and not mm-hmm. not as honest as I am now.
Has your view of solitude changed as you get older?
Yes. I think it has in one sense, and that is that friends are very, very precious because I can't work as much. And because of heart trouble that I now have, it's not serious. I'm not going to die of it, but it makes me unable to work for weeks at a time. And then I realize how precious the friends are who can come and talk and be with me, whereas I really haven't needed that very much until now. And I think that is something of the beginning of old age. But there's also solitude, you see.
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of people, the greatest fear is the fear of being old alone.
Yes.
And the greater fear is of dying alone.
Yes. I can see that very clearly. I'd like to die alone. I mean, I think it would be easier than perhaps having people around. But we all have death in our minds. I mean, after about 60, certainly, I think you can't escape that. I have the feeling, and I've said so in the journals, that we grow towards death, and it's the last great adventure, and we have to be prepared for it. So that I find being old in some ways very exciting, in other ways very limiting, and therefore, you know, I get cross and I get depressed because I can't do things that I want to do anymore, like gardening.
You had a stroke a few years ago.
Yes.
And you have a journal about recovering
from
the stroke. You were alone when you were stricken. How did you cope with that? How did you cope with getting to the hospital?
Well, I waited until 6 o'clock because I didn't want to bother anybody. And at 6, I called a friend of mine who's an RN and said, Janice, I think I've had a slight stroke. And she said, call the doctor at once. I'm coming right away. We'll get an ambulance. And the whole thing began. But you see, it was, luckily, a slight stroke. I was able to pack my suitcase, but I wasn't able to get my breakfast. And it was the left side. You see, that's where I'm so lucky, because if it had been the right side, I wouldn't be able to speak, probably. And I write about what it affected. It was very strange what goes on in your head. I mean, for about a year, I felt quite crazy. All the past just flowed through me, and I couldn't escape it. I was pursued by images of my whole life. So thank God that isn't happening now. And I think I'm now fairly well, and they keep tabs on the possibility of another stroke, of course. I mean, you take medicine and things.
You have a poem with you. Would you read that for us?
Yes, and this fits in, I think, quite well with what we've been talking about. It's the title poem of my last book of poetry, which was called The Silence Now. These days, the silence is immense. It is there deep down, not to be escaped. The twittering flight of goldfinches, the three crows cawing in the distance, only brush the surface of this silence, full of mourning, the long drawn-out tug and sigh of waters never still, the ocean out there and the inner ocean. Only animals comfort because they live in the present and cannot drag us down into those caverns of memory full of loss. They pay no attention to the thunder of distant waves. My dog's eager eyes watch me as I sit by the window thinking. At the bottom of the silence, what lies in wait? Is it love? Is it death? Too early or too late? What is it I can have that I still want? My swift response is to what cannot stay. The dying daffodils, peonies on the way, iris just opening, lilac turning brown in the immense silence where I live alone. It is the transient that touches me, old, those light-shot clouds as the sky clears. A passing glory can still move to tears, moments of pure joy like some fairy gold, too evanescent to be kept or told. And the cat's soft footfall on the stair keeps me alive, makes nowhere into here. At the bottom of the silence, it is she who speaks of an eternal now to me.
What a nice poem. You know, and I should mention that you write so much about your cats and dogs that you've had in your books.
Yes. They're very dear companions.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in 1982... you wrote out a check to a retirement community for them to hold for 5 years from then when you planned on joining. Whatever
yes.
happened with that?
Well, I discovered the people I really wanted to be with, the former dean of the faculty at Wellesley was one of them, would be about 100 by the time I was 80 and going there. So I figured that it wasn't a good idea. And then when I went to see them, I found being in the dining room with nothing but gray heads and nothing but people on the way out. I mean, having difficulty in walking as I do now and all these things, that I found it terribly depressing. And so I canceled it. It's also quite expensive. I'm determined now to die where I am, in a house that I rent from good friends and right on the sea. And when the time comes, it would be cheaper probably to have a live-in housekeeper than to go to a retirement community. But you never know. I mean, what if I have another stroke? You just have to sort of take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life and hope it'll end well.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you about your new novel.
All right, splendid.
But first we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. Mae Sarton is my guest, and her new novel, which we'll talk about in a second, is called The Education of Harriet Hatfield. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mae Sarton is my guest. She's written over 35 books, novels, poetry, essays. She's probably best known for the journals she's written about solitude, aging, and her recovery from a stroke. She has a new novel called The Education of Harriet Hatfield. Let me see if I can describe this novel a little bit. It's about a 60-year-old woman whose companion of 30 years has just died, and the companion has left her an inheritance with which she opens a women's bookstore. And she's being interviewed by a newspaper reporter, and the newspaper reporter asks her if she's a lesbian, and she says that, yes, she is. And that's kind of the headline in the article. the headline is, Lesbian Bookstore Owner Threatened. So suddenly she's kind of public and out, and after living a pretty isolated life, she finds herself in the middle of the lesbian feminist community. The novel is, in a way, about generational differences, I think, between older women and younger women who are lesbians. Do you see it that way?
Well, in some ways, yes. Of course, the point about her coming out as a lesbian is that she is threatened, and that it isn't that she's sudden. People attack her because the bookstore is not like what they are used to in a somewhat blue-collar neighborhood. So that the book is about homophobia. It's about how strange it is that so much hatred and violence can be created just by the presence of, in this case, a very discreet elderly lady who opens a bookstore. But we see these things happening all the time. And every incident in the book of violence is something I know happened. So, I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted to try to say, look, I mean, here we are. We're just ordinary people, just like you. We have the same problems. We're not monsters. We're not... That's what I was trying to get at, and I'm happy because I had a letter yesterday from somebody saying, Harriet is adorable. This really took me by surprise. But you've created such a marvelously warm and funny and character, which is, of course, what I was hoping somebody would say, but so rarely happens.
Well, let me ask you a few things about Harriet and how, if at all, she relates to the way you've lived your life. She's a woman who is 60 at the time of the novel, and she was never really publicly out before. She never really related to other women couples, hated the term lesbian because it seemed like such a primarily sexual word. Does that describe you at all?
I think it describes a great many people, and not only people my age. I think it describes a great many women who are living together and who somewhat shudder at the word lesbian. And it's beginning now to come out. In the book I have, and this really happened to me, it happens to me all the time, a young woman introduced somebody and said, this is my lover. Well, you see, this does take me aback, but it's done all the time now, men also. There you're right, there is a generation gap. But I think Harriet somewhat really does jump over it in one way or another.
Oh, she definitely does.
Yes.
And do you feel that you have too?
Yes, but I think it's very difficult. I mean, I don't think it's easy to come out in front of an audience of 1,000 people and say I'm a lesbian and proud of it. But I do that. But I do it with difficulty. I mean, the homosexual community is a community which is on the whole not liked. You are a little segment that is. So it's not easy. I think it's wrong to say that it's easy. And I think if this book has a value, it's that in a way it takes this not easy thing with perfect honesty and not minimizing it, but rather lightly at the same time, so that you don't put it down. You read it fast and laugh sometimes. That's what I hope.
Now, in 1965, you wrote a novel called Mrs. Stevens Hears the Mermaid Singing.
Yes.
And this was the first novel you wrote that had a lesbian protagonist in it.
It was actually a novel in which I came out, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly agreed to now. Got almost no good reviews, but is now a classic. taught in all the women's studies, the colleges. This is very nice, you know, to know that something that you wrote at a time. My agent, Dermot Russell, one of the best in New York, he's dead now, alas. But, I mean, he said, don't publish it, May. It's going to do you harm. And I said, Dermot, let me give it first to my publishers, to Norton, and if they don't like it, all right. But they did. And my editor at Norton, Eric Swenson, said, we think it's wonderful, and we want to publish it. So this was where they were wonderful. And it came out, as I say, it was no great triumph at the time, but with time, it has somehow, like a good wine, you know, it's gotten better. I think it's a much better book than the Harriet. It's a deeper book, and also it's about women's creativity and about the difference between a woman poet and a male poet.
The novel wasn't well reviewed at the time,
yes,
when it came out in 1965, but how did coming out affect your career as a writer?
Well, I lost two jobs right away. One was to be head of a big public school poetry series in the summer, in summer school in Philadelphia. And they told me, we just feel that this is government money and it might, you know, come out that you were what you are. And so that was the first. And then Christian Science Monitor was doing a series on poetry, which I wrote an essay for, which was to open the series. And they said they couldn't open the series. That wasn't quite as bad with me. But, you know, you pay a price even now.
Mm-hmm. When the gay rights movement came along, did you identify or were you alienated from it initially?
I think neither, because I had already come out, and also I had already made for myself a very solitary life, which was not political, so that it's not in my kind of life to march, for instance. I'm rather ashamed of this. I wish I wanted to, but I think you have to be what you are and not pretend that you're something else.
Well, I think that's a really good point, and it seems strange to me that you'd be kind of embarrassed, because after all, what people love so much about your writing has to do with the life of solitude that you've lived.
Well,
and you,
yes,
you really can't have it both ways.
No, that's true.
You wrote a poem a few years ago called Myself to Me, and in your introduction to the poem, you said, I wrote this poem when I thought I was too old to love. That was some years ago. I learned better.
Yes.
Do you still feel that way, that there's, you know...
Oh, yes. Well, I think that there's always the possibility of a person coming into one's life who excites the waters, so to speak, who makes everything happen again. For a poet, you have to have a muse. Now, when you're 77, of course, it's not the easiest thing in the world to conceive of one arriving, but I never despair.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Yes, I'd be glad to. This is a very short one, which was written for a friend of mine who's since died. But this is really about what it is to be a poet. It's called The Skilled Man, for Bill Vaughan. If someone should ask me how a poem is whittled and willed, just how it is done, you know, with what love, both wary and skilled, I'd suggest that he watch Bill make a thing that does not look hard, like the staff for an old knife, and learn that all that it takes to make a knife new or a word is the subtle exchange of a life.
May Sarton, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer May Sarton. She's the author of many novels, books of poems, and a series of personal journals. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, singer and actress Deborah Harry. She fronted the new wave band Blondie in the late 70s and early 80s, and now she has a new solo album called Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's the orchestra of the 18th century, conducted by Franz Bruggen. In addition to conducting his orchestra in performances on period instruments, Bruggen is one of the world's outstanding recorder players. Coming up, he talks about playing and conducting. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of vintage recordings by the guitarist Eddie Condon. Kevin says they're a reminder that Condon was better than his reputation. And Telly Savalas is back on TV. TV critic David Bianculli tells us whether that's good news or bad. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Firefighters in Pasadena, Texas, outside of Houston, are still battling a huge blaze at a Phillips Petroleum Company plant. An early afternoon explosion and fire could be seen and felt from miles away. Bruce Dorton of member station KUHF reports.
The fire is still out of control, but is being contained. There are reports that as many as 80 people may have been treated for injuries. The explosion blew out windows of homes and businesses miles away. Phillips spokesman Dave Dryden says there are 15 workers still unaccounted for, and he says the exact cause of the explosion is unknown.
We really don't know what happened. Of course, with the fire still out of control, it will be hours, days, maybe even weeks before we are able to get in there and find out exactly what did cause this to happen.
The huge plant employs 900 workers. The fire occurred in the complex's plastics plant. Dryden says there are three different plastics manufactured there, polyethylene, polypropylene, and K-resin. Dryden says the chemicals could cause eye, throat, and skin irritation, but otherwise should not cause any serious consequences. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Houston.
Perhaps worried about travel on the first full workday since last week's earthquake, there was lighter than usual traffic to San Francisco today. But rain-drenched commuters jammed ferry boats, trains, and buses at rush hour, and it went fairly smoothly. The mayor warned today that San Francisco's transportation crisis will last a long time, that it won't go away in a couple of days, and people are going to have to get used to finding other means of transportation. A multi-billion-dollar package of earthquake aid is being readied for votes this week in the House and Senate. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today, the entire California congressional delegation announced its bipartisan support for a $3.8 billion package. The money would be divided between FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, the Federal Highway Administration's Emergency Fund, the Economic Development Agency, and a discretionary fund to be allocated by the president. Earlier today, the White House announced that its estimate of what California needed was much lower, just $2.5 billion. But lawmakers stress that the difference does not represent a battle between the administration and Congress. There will not be a bidding war, says Office of Management and Budget Director Richard Darman. And Republican members of the California delegation say that the administration and Congress are moving today toward a final dollar figure that both can support. The House votes on the package tomorrow. The Senate will vote later this week. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
According to official reports from China, a strong aftershock hit the northern part of that country today, where a series of earthquakes last week caused heavy damage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 26 points to close at 2,662.91 on volume of some 135 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The late jazz guitarist Eddie Condon was famous for assembling interesting bands. In 1929, he organized one of the first recording sessions that brought black and white musicians together. In the 40s, he promoted jazz concerts and opened the first of two New York clubs that would bear his name, clubs that featured the traditional jazz, sometimes known as Dixieland. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a 1957 Condon reissue. He says Condon's zeal as a proselytizer has caused some fans to overlook his musical skills.
Guitarist Eddie Condon is not a fashionable figure these days. Partly that's because the kind of music he championed is passé in most circles. But it's also because he was notorious for attracting more attention with his mouth than with his guitar. Condon was a tireless jazz booster. He'd organize concerts, find jobs for musicians, and butter up reluctant club owners. He also embarrassed some folks by linking hot jazz with serious drinking. He defined the difference between modern beboppers and traditionalists like himself this way. They flat their fifths. We drink ours. His ceaseless chatter spilled over onto the bandstand. On a recording session, he'd keep up a running commentary on the action.
Hyphens!
Eddie Condon is surely the only musician in jazz who'd be prompted to yell hyphets during a bass solo. That dada strain didn't endear him to folks who thought jazz should be treated with high seriousness. So there are lots of reasons why Condon has been undervalued. But a new collection on the Columbia label, Dixieland Jam, recorded at two sessions in 1957, reminds us that Condon wasn't just a blowhard. He also made some awfully good, relaxed, and tasteful music. Here's Condon's take on Bernie Hanigan's When a Woman Loves a Man. That's Billy Butterfield on trumpet with Bob Wilbur on clarinet and Cuddy Cutshall on trombone. The musicians on these recordings also include pianist Gene Schroeder, trumpeter Wild Bill Davison, Condon's favorite drummer, George Wetling, and the hyphets of the bass, Leonard Gaskin, who's best known as a bebop player. His presence confirms that Condon was less doctrinaire than many traditionalists who resented swing musicians, let alone beboppers. He didn't care what a musician's background was, as long as he played with the proper spirit. Some of the best solos on the album are by trombonist Vic Dickinson, a veteran of several swing bands. Condon himself didn't take solos, preferring instead to chomp out rhythm chords with a firm, steady beat. For that reason, he's been compared with Count Basie's low-profile guitarist, Freddie Green. But Green is praised for his selfless restraint, while Condon is often regarded as a marginally talented bum. Like Green, he could add lift to a rhythm section just by his presence, whether you can hear him clearly or not. As one critic has said, the best way to appreciate Condon is to hear a session where he showed up late, and compare tunes made before and after he got there. One nice thing about this new record is you can hear him a little better than usual. On the Dixie Standard Hindustan, Condon and Company approached the airborne swing of the Basie band itself. Here's Bob Wilbur's clarinet solo. Thank you. Eddie Condon was a paradox, a self-effacing motor mouth. But the two sides of his personality are consistent. Condon's role was pushing other musicians, whatever it took, either by touting them loudly or quietly egging them on.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the Eddie Condon All-Stars Dixieland Jam on Columbia. This is Fresh Air. Seldom have period instruments been played with such easy assurance. Seldom have they sounded more glorious or necessary. And seldom have they been put to such expressive purposes. For once there is a truly authentic performance, as advertised, one that investigates what was new and exciting about a symphonic adventure in 1800. Music critic Peter Davis wrote that about a recording of Beethoven's First Symphony performed by the orchestra of the 18th century. The orchestra was founded in the Netherlands by Frans Bruggen, one of the pioneers in the authentic instrument movement. Before he started conducting in 1981, he had already established himself as the outstanding recorder player of his age. His orchestra begins a North American tour next month. I asked Frans Bruggen why he's dedicated his orchestra to performing music of the 18th century.
It is my specialism. It is my life, you know. Not that I'm not interested in the later centuries, but the 18th century offers particular great masterworks for a real symphony orchestra, and that is what interests me.
Mm-hmm. When you play a work that's familiar to many people, like Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, what qualities do you think you emphasize in your performance using period instruments in the language of the time?
Well, actually, those qualities are given automatically. The instruments are so different from our modern symphony instruments that what you hear is another Jupiter symphony, so to speak, with other mixtures of sounds.
Musicians from 14 different countries in your orchestra of the 18th century. Did you travel around the world looking for the right musicians?
Well, this world of specialists is rather small still, so everybody knows everybody, and you know where sits a good person which you possibly could use very well.
Do they all live in the Netherlands now, or do you, it must be hard to rehearse if they don't?
Well, it is quite an organization indeed. Though those people come out of their 14 or 15 countries to Amsterdam at a certain time. Then we rehearse there during 8 days, two programs, and we go on a subsequent tour consisting of 20 concerts, not less and not more. After that, it's over, and the same thing happens half a year later. So it is a kind of festival orchestra with always the same personnel, which meets during 2 times 5 to 6 weeks per year.
You have a new recording, and one of the performances on the new recording is Beethoven's Symphony No. 2. Is there a passage within Beethoven's Symphony No. 2 that you think is particularly revelatory when you hear it played in the language of the period?
Maybe the slow movement, the second movement.
Mm-hmm. And what's revelatory about hearing it?
Well, you have such a delicate, natural balance between winds and strings, which is always hard to achieve with a modern symphony orchestra, but which is naturally given to us without us having to do any artificial balancing.
What were your early revelations playing the music on original instruments?
The revelation for me was that suddenly became clear why that music was written in such a way and in no other way. So everything fitted together suddenly.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever made fun of or mocked for trying to play on original instruments when you were first getting started?
Of course, sure.
What would people say?
What did they say? Out of tune, not together, ugly, etc., etc. And sometimes they were right. I speak about the 1950s now.
Mm-hmm.
This movement of playing on historical instruments dates from in its vigor. Dates from immediately after the Second World War in Europe.
Now, you were a performer, a soloist, until you started conducting in 1981. What led you into conducting?
Well, somebody has to do it. And with a symphony orchestra, you need a conductor, really.
Mm-hmm. And you wanted the orchestra, so you figured you might as well conduct?
I wanted the orchestra very much because I thought that I was really fed up with symphony orchestras playing the Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven symphonies. Good performances sometimes, but stylistically very wrong, and with the wrong instruments in hand, so the sound completely very different from the intentions of those composers.
You started off playing flute. What did you find?
May I correct you there?
Oh,
no,
yeah.
I started off playing recorder.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes.
I think very few people start off playing recorder. Why did you?
Doesn't every child do?
Yeah, well, I did, and I'll tell you. When I was in sixth grade, our music appreciation classes were...
Yes, of course.
We're learning to play the flutophone, which is a plastic version of the recorder. And then when we got really proficient in flutophone, we graduated to the recorder and played real dreck, I have to say.
Yeah.
But a lot of people continue to go through life thinking of the recorder as a toy or something close to it.
Do they still here in America?
Well, I think some people do.
Oh, I see. Well,
I'm sure you have been exposed to that, haven't you?
Yeah, but that was back in the late 40s. That is more than 40 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Not any longer now in Europe.
Uh-huh.
Good heavens, no.
Uh-huh. So why was the recorder your first instrument? What did you love about the sound or the feel of it?
Well, I learned it in school, and I was in love with it. I cannot express myself better. I was in love with the instrument, and I wanted to do it all the time.
You once referred to making use of the monotony of the recorder, and I was wondering what you meant by that.
Yeah, well, the recorder has not much dynamic range. It stays mainly in the middle part of dynamics, not too soft, not too loud either. And that is part of its nature, and I love that modesty.
In addition to playing music of earlier centuries, you have played a lot of 20th century music and have been in a 20th century music group called Sour Cream. Is that group
yes.
still together?
Still together, yeah. Yes.
Do you ever wish that you played contemporary music all the time? I mean, would that make life easier in any way?
It would certainly make life more natural, because playing your own present day, your own ages, music is the most natural thing to do, of course. It would not make me happier, because I'm so interested in this museum of music, of good composers who do not live anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's what you think of your work as being, as almost a curator at a museum?
It is, actually, yeah. It is. One tries to restore the paintings and exhibit them well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure, madam. Bye-bye.
Franz Bruggen and his Orchestra of the 18th Century begin a North American tour next month at the Orpheum Theater in Los Angeles. They will also perform in Berkeley, Atlanta, Boston, and at Lincoln Center in New York. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, this is your first day back in Washington, your first working day after covering the earthquake in San Francisco.
Right, and I'm glad to be back where the ground isn't moving, Terry, but it was a remarkable experience, and we met a lot of amazing people who've done amazing things during the course of the earthquake. We're going to cover the effort to commute into San Francisco, which apparently was not as bad as they thought it might be. The weather was terrible, and a lot of people decided to stay home. We're also covering the Rafael Edmond trial, which may be an example to us of what trying drug kingpins will be like, and the man who wrote Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover is with us.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Wednesday night, a TV movie on the USA Network signals the return of one of TV's old familiar faces, Telly Savalas. Next month, Savalas' best-known character, Kojak, will resurface. TV critic David Bianculli says, don't get your hopes up too high.
Get this. Telly Savalas is starring this week in a new TV movie, playing an actor who used to star in a TV detective show. In the movie, he gets hired as a real detective. But Telly Savalas, in real life, has found a job that won't require a career switch, or even much of a stretch. Starting next month, he'll be playing Kojak again in a new series for ABC. What's the deal here? Why, all of a sudden, is Telly all over the telly? I have no idea, but I do know this. The Hollywood detective is terrible. The first episode of the new Kojak series is a lot better, but only by comparison. In The Hollywood Detective, Savalas plays Harry Bell, who used to star in a TV show called John Crown, Private Investigator. Now he's out of money, full of booze and down on his luck, until a female fan comes to him and asks him to investigate her boyfriend's disappearance.
I am an actor. I just play a detective, do you understand? Lights, TV, camera, action, so forth. Goodbye. And get treatment.
Oh, I know you're on TV, don't you see? Come on, I don't know who else to go to. Oh, please, Mr. Bell, I'm desperate. But you probably need that money. I've been feeling guilty for weeks.
Sorry, sister. I'm a very busy man.
No, he's not. So after complaining a bit, he takes the money and becomes a real private eye. But not a very good one, since he spends most of his time being chased or being beaten up. But the action isn't exciting, the humor isn't funny, and there's nothing at all that makes Hollywood Detective worth watching. Not even the plot is original. USA Network has a whole series called Diamonds that's all about former TV detectives who run a real-life detective agency. Now, the only reason to watch Hollywood Detective is to see Telly Savalas poke fun at his own image. And trust me, that's not a good enough reason.
No more comedy.
Could you give us the name of your old television show? Which network?
Oh, yes, good question. John Crown, private investigator, NBC. You know, there's talk recently about renewing the series. And I...
Well, they are reviving Kojak this season as part of the revolving ABC mystery wheel that also has, among other things, new episodes of Columbo. But Columbo has aged a lot more gracefully than Kojak has. In the mid-70s, Kojak used to be the toughest cop show around, but that was before Hill Street Blues changed the rules. Nowadays, the best Kojak has to offer is its effective use of New York City's streets, and a scene or two where Kojak gets to talk tough about crime. Here, he's being interviewed by a reporter about the drug epidemic.
People think that it's all about narcotics. Oh, no. It's also about money. Drugs, why, right? Maybe it's tough, but you can say no to drugs. But can you say no to money? Cash?
There's also good chemistry between Kojak and his new assistant, who's played by Andre Brower. But the plot of this new two-hour Kojak is too far-fetched, and the most weight Telly Savalas carries as Kojak these days is around his belly. Who loves you, baby? Not me. In Kojak, I can take you or leave you. And in Hollywood Detective, I'll definitely leave you.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Vablitis, Dan Lachlan, and Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Blondie started off as a new wave band, but ended up topping the charts. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Deborah Harry, the former lead singer of Blondie, who now has a dual career as a singer and actress. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.